Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, July 21st. 2 weeks after Super Typhoon Bobby hit the Marianas Islands, we get a report from the American Red Cross out in the field. We get an update on a controversial empty home tax. A city commission shot down a proposal to put the issue to voters this fall. We learn about a decline in native birds on the Garden Isle that has left scientists scratching their heads, from forests filled with birdsong to eerie silence. And we geek out over a new state law that aims to ban 99% of electronic smoking devices. It's meant to cut back on e-waste and curb underage vaping. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been 2 weeks since Super Typhoon Bobby swept through the Marianas Islands. Its eye passed over the tiny island of Rota, and its winds damaged parts of Guam and Saipan and Tinian, which were still just recovering from an earlier super typhoon back in April. Guam has been serving as a staging area for not just FEMA disaster workers, but the American Red Cross. Hundreds of volunteers are in place and are working to help those impacted on the islands of the Western Pacific. I was just on island yesterday and talked to Ken Quintanilla, executive director of the Guam Red Cross. The Guam Hilton serves as nerve central for the disaster response.
As part of the American Red Cross, we're here to support the people of the Marianas with this recovery. We're very fortunate that we have over 300 American Red Cross volunteers and teams deployed to Guam, Saipan, Tinian, and Rota to provide so many services, from sheltering to feeding, from damage assessment to recon, to connecting with our local and government partners. And just trying to find ways to support our people with recovery, whether it's through financial assistance, distribution of emergency supplies, cleanup kits, connecting them with our health services, and so many other services that they're here for.
Well, you know, I know that there were Red Cross volunteers on my flight over here, and there was one gentleman that I talked to who said, well, he was here for Sinlaku, went home, and then is back again. And so, yeah, it's just amazing, the outpouring from these volunteers from all over the country.
Yeah, so even before Typhoon Bobby struck, the Red Cross activated already. So they were planning off island, and they were deployed here before the typhoon struck so they can prepare for what's to come. Just like you mentioned, volunteers were here from Typhoon Sinlaku, but surprisingly also volunteers that helped during Typhoon Mawar in 2023 deployed back again. So they were familiar with the shelters, they were familiar with the streets and the areas that were struck hard before. They were familiar with the people as well. And most of all, they were familiar with our culture and the way that our people respond as well. So it's been very reassuring and hopeful to have such a great people back on our island to support. And people keep asking me, like, what are the differences, or what are the biggest challenges, or what have we learned? And I think we just get stronger every time someone comes over to help respond.
Yeah, I mean, one gentleman said he just really understood the definition of community, coming here and seeing what people do in the face of a disaster.
Yeah, and you know, I think the greatest thing that we've been able to share with these national volunteers is that, you know, our island people are so resilient, but even the most resilient sometimes need support. And activating these national volunteers and connecting them with our local volunteers and our local leaders and our Guam chapter and our CNMI chapter has just made us one big force to support our community.
Well, I see all the volunteers throughout the hotel property. They were just unloading water from a van, you know, into another van. And so, yeah, it's distributing supplies. And I overheard a conversation. They were going to be helping with feeding. And what's the count you know, island by island for folks in shelters at this point?
There's currently over 400, I believe 462 as of today, in 6 Red Cross managed shelters. On Guam, we have 2 tier 2 shelters, and that's a bigger portion of the population. So we have a shelter at the Ordat Chalampago Multipurpose Emergency Shelter. There's 203 there. We're also utilizing the Estumbo Gym up north in Dedido, and that has 128. So about a little over 300 of shelter residents here on Guam. Every day I've been visiting the shelter since we opened last week. And it's been great to see our teams connecting with them, providing feedings. We just started shelter resident transition today, as they call it, SRT. And it's basically our teams getting to connect and interview the clients one-on-one to find out, what do you need to get home? Is your home destroyed? You just need materials, building supplies, cleanup kits? Are you needing more financial assistance? Are you a pre-disaster homeless? So we can connect them with our government partners and the homeless groups to see what kind of support we can provide them.
And then I understand that Rota, which was, you know, I think the hardest hit, because I think the eye was larger than the island is what people were saying, that initially there were just folks being flown in and out, but that there may be some limited housing for some of the volunteers now?
Well, just like in any island communities, resources and capacities may be a challenge, but we've made it work. You know, we've been able to connect with our local volunteers there, and they've been able to help house our Red Cross volunteers. They're cooking with each other. They're making it work. And today, our financial assistance started with Rota. So already over 100 plus have been paid out already to find out what kind of support. Just like you mentioned, Rota was hit the hardest. It was the biggest impact. And we've taken that into consideration with prioritizing them, prioritizing our volunteers and our teams to get deployed there to distribute emergency supplies, like I mentioned, cleanup kits, feedings, and just connecting with the people there.
Do we know how many are in shelters?
I know the number has changed, but I can get the information from you. But they're part of the overall total of 462 as of today. But I know that Guam is the largest of the shelters, but I know that some might be on the path, whether it's to rebuilding or to tents. That a lot of the different factors for the different islands.
And then Saipan was hit hardest with Sinlaku and then Tinian as well. But then just to have this, you know, 1-2 punch with this second super typhoon, can you give us some sense about those other islands?
Yeah, so I think it's been very clear that everyone is still on the road to recovery. If you haven't fully recovered from Sinlaku between that time and now. So I think I don't want to say has made it easier, but it's been, we're very familiar with who the clients were from Sinlaku to now. So we're kind of serving the same people in addition to others who have dealt with this second blow with Bobby. So the sentiment, though, has just been hope and resiliency and coming together. Because it's not just the Red Cross teams that are providing the support. Like in Saipan, for instance, in Sinlaku, we had so many youth volunteers. And maybe it was a combination of them not having power and just wanting to help their neighbor. We had so many volunteers, local volunteers, work so closely with our Red Cross teams. And whether, you know, it wasn't just the people rolling up their sleeves and getting out there in the community, it was our youth who were doing the little things that they could. Everyone made a difference with this overall operation.
And then I know in talking with some FEMA staff, you know, they were saying that they were brought in, you know, for disaster response to get emergency power and water. And fortunately, Rota got, I think, water fairly quickly. So that was good. I mean, power is going to be another story. You know, we're hearing that on Tinian, possibly they have to rebuild the power plant. But yeah, everybody's in a little different space when it comes to getting just the basic needs back up again.
Yeah, I've actually been attending on Guam. I've been attending the governor's cabinet meetings where all the different government partners who are in support of Typhoon Bobby, like from the Guam Water Works Authority to the Guam Power Authority to the Guam Memorial Hospital, all trying to find what resources they have to not just support Guam, but our brothers and sisters in the CNMI. So I believe even like the Guam Power Authority, they were able to send out their GPA trucks and their teams, just like for Sinlaku, to go support the Marianas. The governor herself flew to Rota and spoke with the mayor there and was basically saying, just like the Red Cross does, how can we help? And I know they mentioned they needing some like military support and other partners to just help them get back on their feet.
Yes, and we heard that, that the military was bringing in emergency generators, that kind of thing. And fortunately, I think the Coast Guard has given the all clear for the some of the ports to be open, you know, the Rota port, and then figuring out how to barge supplies or however they get those essentials in.
Yeah, so even, you know, like whether it's if a flight's getting delayed or ports not being open, we never just waited. Everything as we, I guess we're waiting for the airports to open, we were doing all the planning, like connecting with our local volunteers who were on the ground already, saying this is what we're gonna do, this is what we need there to, and once everything opened, we moved quickly. No one just sat there and waited. We were planning, we were positioning people, connecting with our partners, finding ways to support. No time was wasted with this operation.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting for me to learn that the Hawaii Blood Bank, I think, had sent supplies over just in advance of knowing that, you know, if it got really bad, that they would have a supply ready on hand if need be.
Yeah, so the American Red Cross, our Guam chapter and our Sinamite chapter, we fall under the Pacific Islands region. So a lot of our partners and counterparts are in Hawaii, and whether and when as our volunteers were being deployed from the States, and they would be positioned in Hawaii before they got here, they were still working there as well, connecting with everyone. And whether you were deployed on the ground or you're activated virtually, everyone played a role, especially our teams in Hawaii.
And is there anything that you have requested that you haven't gotten yet as far as supplying the needs of the community?
I'm sure there's several things that we could use, but we've never been quiet about it. We've spoken about it. We've reached out to partners, whether it's the littlest things from toys for the kids to generators to water supply, whatever is needed, we'd be happy to connect with our government, federal, local, regional partners to make it happen. And for the most part, it's been working. And whether and if it wasn't and if it's something that's going to take some time or needing more like funding and whatnot, we've connected with everyone just to do it.
And then I know there are needs for food and all of that, but I know they often say sometimes it's just the financial assistance that, you know, is the speediest way to help the victims in need.
Yeah, so the two biggest things that we're asking of people is, one, volunteer. So you can go to redcross.org to find volunteer opportunities, and training will be available for you. We have our disaster event-based volunteers that basically, if you want to volunteer one time or become a general volunteer, we'll find an opportunity for you to do, whether it's feeding, working in the shelters, answering phones, distributing emergency supplies or cleanup kits, or just working with the people. And then the second way to help is by donating. We've put together a special designation for Typhoon Bavi, just like we did with Sinlaku. And so you can go to our website at redcross.org, click on that link, and they'll be able, it'll be able to help you on how to support and donate for this operation. Whether you're an individual or a big corporation, any kind of support is definitely going to be appreciated.
That was Ken Quintanilla, Executive Director of the Guam Chapter of the American Red Cross, talking about disaster relief for a Super Typhoon Bavi.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
From a European conflict zone,
driving north from Kyiv, the signs of war start to be more visible.
To hard times in Southeast Asia,
I meet a man who has been waiting in line for diesel for 6 days.
To the astonishing beauty of remote places.
My welcome to the waters off of East Greenland has come from two whales.
Let us take you there. Listen to the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy's Empower Grant Program, supporting local businesses with their energy projects. Learn more at hawaiienergy.com/empower.
Waterloo Civil Beat has a story today that looks at the latest attempt to tax empty housing units. Reporter Ben Angarone joins us this morning. Good morning, Ben.
Morning, Catherine. How are you?
I am good. And you were able to track the Honolulu Charter Commission meeting, and this issue came up before the members.
Yes, yes. So for some brief context for anybody who doesn't know what a charter commission is or does, this convenes every 10 years in Honolulu, and the idea is that anybody can submit a proposed amendment to our city charter, which is like our constitution. And this group of 13 volunteers, appointed by the mayor and city council members, they decide which of these proposed amendments will make it onto the ballot in November. And then from there, anybody who votes can vote and say which amendments they want added to the charter and which ones they don't. And so this empty homes tax has been talked about before as a straightforward new city ordinance to be talked about by city council members. But this format was slightly different. In this way, the Charter Commission members were deciding, do they want an empty homes tax to appear on the ballot for all of Oahu's general election voters to decide on?
Yes, and the charter is really the operating Bible for the city. And so, you know, the fact that they took this up to me was fascinating.
Yeah, they go through, like, I want to say they had about 295 proposal submissions this year. And then the empty homes tax was one of the last 20 or so that they had really whittled down. Because, as you might imagine, not every single proposal, even if they like the idea, is really appropriate for the city charter. Because it is this sort of bigger, broader document rather than a specific kind of law thing. And for what it's worth, maybe a more helpful way to describe that is, for example, with this empty homes tax, the original way the proposal was submitted had things saying, like, you know, here's what the tax rate should be and everything like that. Whereas the final thing that they voted on yesterday, it was a much broader structure where it said there should be an empty homes tax. It should be used to help pay for affordable housing things in the city using the revenue. But a lot of these details, it was leaving for the city council to decide and for the mayor's administration to decide in its budget and fiscal services kind of administrative little details. Does that make some sense?
Yes. And your story points out, though, that some members of the commission felt that this was not something that the commission ought to take up.
Correct. Yes. So this was really interesting, I thought. When we look back at the reasons why people were against it during the city council meetings, a lot of what you were hearing was people maybe saying that they have a second home here, they worked hard, and they don't want to have to pay the higher tax. In the Charter Commission meeting yesterday, interestingly, a lot of the discussion was more about practical capacity and about the sort of administrative reasons for, should this be something that the city charter does, or should it be something that city council members vote on? One of the commissioners was even talking about how in other cities, because there are a few other ones in the U.S. and Vancouver, Canada is probably the more famous international example of this, but these other places did it via city ordinance through the normal sort of lawmaking routine procedure. Here in Honolulu, we've had a few attempts of that in the last 5 or 10 years, none of which have actually made it. Most recently was in 2024 when Tommy Waters and Radiant Cordero introduced Bill 46. And that made it, at the end of that year, all the way to a final vote. But then it turned out they didn't have all of the votes that they needed to pass it. And so they postponed the bill for a final vote to be determined later when they hoped to have the political will. And this bill will now automatically die on August 1st. So we will see if Tommy Waters eventually actually does schedule this final vote on the empty homes tax for his city council members. He told me in May that he is not going to let it die, and we will see if that actually occurs.
Yeah, and his concern has to do with what, possible override?
It mostly had to do with even just the numbers on the city council, because at the time they were down 5-4. They needed to flip one more city council member. But you bring up a great point also of potential mayoral veto, because the mayor has used to be interested in empty homes tax when he ran back in 2020. He even put on a Civil Beat Q&A. He was interested in this idea. But more recently, when I've talked to him, he said, no, we looked into that, and it's not worth the sort of administrative burden that we'd have to take on with it. And so he's not very keen about it anymore. So that would be another political consideration for the city council members to think about. Is the mayor going to support it? Now, this Charter Commission amendment would have bypassed that. It wouldn't have been a concern. But if they do end up going the route of a city council bill again, then that may become a concern.
All right. Fascinating story. All the intrigue back there at City Hall. But thank you so much, Ben.
Cool. Thanks so much, Catherine. Have a good one.
We've been hearing from Ben Angrone. Check out his story at civilbeat.org. Conservation scientists are calling it an alarming decline in native bird populations. In the past year, Kauai has seen dramatic reductions in its honeycreeper numbers, including the Amakihi, the Iiwi, and the Anianiau, which is Hawaii's smallest honeycreeper. Scientists called an emergency meeting this May to discuss urgent next steps. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with two of the leaders sounding the alarm. Collie Crampton is the program manager of the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project, and Justin Height is Mosquito Project Coordinator for the state's Division of Forestry and Wildlife. Before that, he conducted field surveys with Crampton's group for nearly a decade. Island-wide surveys 3 years ago showed that Kauai's native bird species had been largely holding steady. But earlier this year, scientists in the field started noticing that something was off. Crampton starts us off.
For Anianiau, we had about a two-thirds reduction in the number of territories and nests we found between 2025 and 2026. So ongoing, really urgent declines for Anianiau. And at our other field site, a second field site, we weren't finding Anianiau at all. I think we found one pair where the previous year we had found six. And so then we're like, well, scratching our heads, right? Because we're scientists that we really like to deal in numbers, but it's obvious that we've got a problem. Like, people are not regularly not seeing Amakihi on any given day at either of our field sites. And we're like, okay, is this just restricted to our field sites where we work at in the far remote Alakai, or is this a bigger problem? And what's really important to note for Amakihi in particular is their stronghold has traditionally been Koke'e. And so we don't work in Koke'e. Usually we just know this from these range-wide surveys we do every 5 years, but we're like, what we're going to do is we're going to repeat the range-wide surveys in the Koke'e area, kind of out of sequence. And we saw one Amakihi on all of these survey trails that we usually follow compared to dozens in 2023. And the other source we reached out to was eBird. As you know, like, a lot of people like to track their observations on citizen science platforms like eBird. And the point is, they were not reporting Amakihi where they should be seeing Amakihi. We called an emergency meeting of all of our partners in May, trying to figure out what to do with very limited data and trying to pull together the threads of data we had without these, you know, official range-wide surveys. And basically, we think we have gone from thousands of Amakihi and thousands of Anianiau in 2023 to hundreds. And we don't know exactly how many hundreds because we just don't have the quality of data to say so, but it's hundreds. And this puts us in the position where we were with Akeke'e in 2024, which by the next year meant we were not seeing Akeke'e on the landscape. So we knew this was like time to act. And so that's what we've been doing ever since.
Is it fair to say that this kind of rapid decline took you all a little bit by surprise?
Absolutely. When we drew the best fitting line through the data in the 2023 counts, it projected that these species would go extinct several years out, like 5 and 10 years out, not 2 and 3 years later. And so, you know, really, we were drawing the wrong shape of curve for these data, unbeknownst to us, because there are what we call in ecology sometimes these tipping points. Mm-hmm. That we're just, you know, everything shifts and you can no longer connect the dots in ways you were connecting them before.
This past winter was just an exceptionally difficult year, and something dramatic did happen and did change, and that all of a sudden, you know, everyone was creeping up towards the edge of the cliff, and then it looks like some of them fell off.
And so I think we are surmising that there was something to do with an uptick in avian malaria on the landscape this last winter. We do know that in this one site in Koke'e, where we have been trapping mosquitoes now for a couple of years, mosquito numbers through the spring and summer of 2024 were bubbling, and early 2025 were bubbling along at, I don't know, a mosquito per trap night, maybe on a, so one mosquito per trap per night. That's the kind of how we measure mosquitoes. And then occasionally would tick up to, you know, four, or maybe on a really bad day, seven mosquitoes per trap per night at this one site, which is our by far worst site. The Koke site is lower in elevation and appears to have different climactic factors than the rest of the sites that we monitor mosquitoes at. And then suddenly, boom, in mid-fall, November timeframe, we started seeing an uptick in the numbers of mosquitoes per trap per night in ways that mosquito biologists are scratching their heads at. Like, they have never seen week over week or month over month increases of the magnitude we saw, such that by January, we were seeing 300 mosquitoes per trap per night at that site.
Wow.
And what is important to know about that site is that we have not, for the last decade, controlled mosquitoes in the Koke area. Our mosquito control efforts have all been focused on the southeastern Alakai Plateau, where the threatened and endangered species have been persisting.
Justin, Callie alluded to this, but it's one thing to look at these numbers on a piece of paper or as a scientist look at graphs, but you have deep history with the field work aspect here. And I just wonder how that feels, like you can look at it on paper, but it's different to see it like in real life.
Thank you. From speaking with the field crews and talking with the people who were out there collecting the data, it was emotionally devastating. I think when they were getting to these traps, first of all, I mean, they know there's a problem because at camp, they can't sleep at night. These camps we have, like, people are kind of like sleeping under tarps, but out in the open. Like, they weren't sleeping kind of inside a tent or inside a mosquito proof area for the most part.
Because we've never needed it.
We've never needed it. These areas are put, that's why the birds were still there. There weren't mosquitoes plaguing every moment. And so they could barely sleep at night. So they knew that there was something absolutely catastrophic that was happening. They were going into the forest. They were catching huge numbers of mosquitoes in the traps. They were being bit all night. And I think even at that point, the birds hadn't yet started to decline. At the beginning of this mosquito surge, the birds were still there. And then it was more just the feeling of the field crews during this season as it progressed, of just like the quietness, the silence, the emptiness, like, of the forest. And this is just hard. I mean, I think these are like lots of, you know, people who really, really care passionately about this work, care passionately about the birds, and like being at the front lines of it and just seeing it happen, seeing the mosquitoes rising and seeing the birds declining, was just a painful thing to go through and to watch.
When we described the Akikiki declines back in 2020, you know, we were mapping territories, and it was like, the way we described it is you have a neighborhood, and one by one, the houses go dark and there's nobody home. And, you know, it's due to an calamitous event like the plague back in London in the day, or at the time we were all experiencing COVID and people were dying in hospital beds because that's how bad COVID was. We're like, that's like watching your loved ones die on a respirator in COVID, except you're watching like through the door, like there's with this feeling of powerlessness, right? And I think that's how the crews feel, like they're losing these animals that they have come to think of as cohabitants of this forest with them.
And I think what's been really hard is just seeing just how bad it was. You know, I think there was even the last wild Akikiki was seen almost a year ago, not quite a year ago now, Pakele, like this older female. And yeah, so she hasn't been seen since August. And there's just this deep sadness now. I think, like, you know, going to her territory and again and again and again, not seeing her, anyone, and, you know, being able to like put your hand on like old nest trees of hers and like just, and know that she's not there anymore. And that maybe there's, for the first time in human history, there might not be any Akikiki left on Kauai right now. And then just understanding that that's, you know, there's, I think, one or two maybe Akeke'e that the project knows about up in the forest. And, you know, there's a female who built a single nest. And so just ray of hope of like, my goodness, like, she's actually got a nest. This is incredible. She laid three eggs, and then eventually she abandoned it and left. And so those three eggs are still sitting there up in that nest, up in the canopy. And then just understanding like what we're up against with how fast the Amakihi and Aniani'au have fallen. And like, it's not like we could reasonably assume that that's going to stop right now. I mean, that trajectory might keep going, and that we really are looking at a very near future on Kauai where the endemic honeycreepers may be gone, and that the EEVE, like one of the most beautiful birds in the world, the EEVE, like the crimson and scarlet colors of it, the bill. I mean, it's such a iconic and beautiful, incredible animal. And there are so few left on Kauai, and that they really may be gone, and that Kauai will have to contend with the fact that like it no longer has EEVE here. And they'll persist on Maui, they'll persist on Hawaii Island, but they might not on Kauai.
Those were scientists Colly Crampton and Justin Height, and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have more from the interview right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, committed to supporting Hawaii food producers and makers. Learn more about its locally sourced Mountain Apple brand products at ktasuperstores.com.
You're walking down a flight of stairs and feel a twinge in your knee. You think, uh-oh, did I tear something?
It's very easy to believe that pain lives exclusively in the body part that hurts. But neuroscience tells us that is not true.
Incorporating the mind into our understanding of pain, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Ulupono Initiative, committed to a sustainable Hawaii, investing and partnering with local communities to help strengthen self-sufficiency and resilience throughout the islands. Ulupono.com.
Welcome back. Let's get back to our conversation with scientists Colly Crampton and Justin Height. They have each spent more than a decade monitoring native bird populations on Kauai, and they've noticed a dramatic decline in key honeycreeper key species since the fall. They convened an emergency meeting in May to discuss next steps. HPR's Maddie Bender asked if this means they've had to pivot on existing plans. Here's Crampton.
Yes and no. So I think part of it is a doubling down, like additional urgency to the plan we already had, which was to collect Aniani Ao eggs this spring. What we had not planned on doing this spring was collecting Amakihi eggs. So we added Amakihi into the mix, and we were able to collect one Amakihi nest, and there are now two baby Amakihi in conservation breeding facilities. And then the other thing that we had not really planned on doing this spring was collecting any adult birds. And now we're looking at fall. You know, we tried to collect as many adults and chicks. We had never collected chicks before, so we started collecting chicks from the nest. We intended to do both species, Aniani Ao and Amakihi. In fact, we were only successful with Aniani Ao. And now the new tool in the box that we're really beginning to think of is whether or not we should consider translocation of Aniani Ao to either Maui or Hawaii Island, which has mosquito-free habitat because they have higher elevations than we do here on Kauai. And so that's currently the sort of the biggest new change on the table. We are undergoing cultural consultations on that front to make sure that it's akamai or not, what's the word? I guess pono with Hawaiian people, but that's what us scientists are recommending we do, is add translocation as a strategy into our toolbox to expand the options for these birds.
I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about what they can do, wondering, because our native birds are so beloved, because they are species that people care so deeply about, how they can be a part of the solution right now. And I'll just say, I mean, Colly, it was really interesting to me to hear that you look at eBird, and so this community science type, like citizen science reporting, to monitor bird populations. So anything like that or anything listeners should know about ways to help or get involved?
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that point up, because it was not on my how you can help list. But yes, we actually are, these birds, the Anianiau and the Amakihi, have now become so rare, especially in the Kokei area, that we are soliciting any sightings of yellow birds. It doesn't really matter if you're not a good enough birder to tell them apart from an Amakihi or an Anianiau, although we would hope that you could tell it apart from a white eye, which sometimes they do confuse birds with. And so those can be recorded on eBird. We do look on eBird. This is now the second time in my career that I've relied on eBird. I actually relied on eBird formerly for the Anianiau project. And they can record them on eBird, or they can send them with photos and recordings, especially audio recordings, to info@kauaiforestbirds.org. But yes, the biggest thing is that we would really like to impart upon our listeners that the kinds of projects we are doing to save our birds are extraordinarily resource intensive. And we need our listeners' help to get those resources flowing our direction. So whether that be assisting us with this translocation funding for this translocation project, whether this, we actually also have a goal of having aviaries here on Kauai as a stopping over point for our birds. So whether it's helping us to fund those aviaries here on Kauai, whether that's helping us continue our mosquito control programs here on Kauai, anything that people can do to help keep money flowing our way is super helpful. So that means that please reach out to your legislators. The green fees, which hopefully will become a regular fixture in Hawaii going forward, are intended for conservation purposes. And it would be really wonderful to see some of those come our way to help fund these important conservation initiatives here on Kauai. And I guess the final thing that I really want to remind our listeners is that the ultimate goal of all of these efforts to save the birds is to make sure that there is a future for birds on Kauai. So mosquito control protects the remaining individuals here on Kauai. And the goal of conservation breeding and translocation is to hold insurance populations of these birds for us in sort of trust while we manage the threats of mosquitoes and other threats on the landscape, so that eventually their, if not them, then their descendants will return to Kauai. But all of this is, as I said, a very expensive endeavor, and it will take a lot of public goodwill and a lot of public funding. So that those are the most important ways that people can help.
Anything you'd add, Justin?
I would be remiss of me not to have some hopeful messages. I think especially before when I like spoke about just how kind of sad it can be and how hard this can be. Like, I really do want to say that like we need to recognize like kind of what has happened on Kauai and what the lesson really is. And like that we need to be able to save these birds. We understand what's coming, like that this is what is coming for Maui. This is what is coming for Hawaii. We need to see that this will be happening in the future. Like if we don't do something, this will happen and those birds will be lost as well. So we have to act now. And like on Kauai, if we got all of the resources in the world right now, it would still be just so hard because what we're up against is so difficult. But like on Maui, on Hawaii, there's still so much time. There are still so many birds. There's still so many species that are not at the edge. They're not at the brink right now, and that we can act and we can save them. And so it's just everyone needs to see what has happened, understand that this is real, that this is coming, and we need to do something about it.
Those were Kauai scientists Kali Crampton and Justin Height. Crampton is the program manager for the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project. Height works with the state as its mosquito project coordinator. You can find out more at kauaiforestbirds.org. Disposable vapes are being disposed of for good starting next year. The governor recently signed Senate Bill 2175 into law. The new rule will prohibit the sale of non-refillable and non-rechargeable e-cigarettes. HBR's Kevin Allen spoke with Kaneohe residents about how they feel about the so-called vape ban. Some, like Clay, use vapes to get off cigarettes in hopes that the change will come with a renewed look at the Hawaii Tobacco Quitline that provides free nicotine patches, gum, and lozenges.
What got you into vaping? Were you trying to get off cigarettes or was...
Yeah, it actually worked. I got off cigarettes for a while, but then I vaped again and I haven't stopped since. It's been like 10 years. Yeah, but no, I remember when they first came out, I had the ones that looked like cigarettes back in the day. Yeah. And you had to like screw it into this little contraption. But yeah, no. Yeah, probably do need to quit though. It's probably better for you. But
looking at the future now, when this ban goes through and disposable vapes kind of are off shelves, do you think you might go back to smoking cigarettes? Or I mean, what...
No. No smoking cigarettes. I don't know what they're going to do. Wouldn't there just be like a black market for electronic vapes? Are they going to start arresting people with disposable vapes? Is that a part of the thing?
It's just the sale of them.
I don't know. I feel like there's going to be like a way around it. Yeah. But I don't, you know, it's cool if you don't want to like give it to kids and stuff. That's not good because, yeah, getting off of nicotine is pretty hard. One of the hardest things to do. So I get what they're going for, but like just, I don't know, just raise the minimum age requirement or something. Maybe to like 25 or something. Absolutely. Maybe instead of just banning it for people because they want people to quit smoking cigarettes. And so they tax them super high, but then they're getting rid of vaping. So it's just... You're just trying to force people to smoke cigarettes again and be more unhealthy?
Several dozen vape products will still remain available for purchase in the state. The law includes a carve-out for products approved by the Food and Drug Administration. We also spoke with State Representative Scott Matayoshi about the ban he championed, including asking him whether specific products will pass muster under the new law.
The tobacco industry is insidious. Every time we create a law, they try to find a way around it. And sometimes they're finding a way around it as we're writing the law. They're that good. So by the time the law kicks in January 1st, 2027, it's not known if it's going to ban all disposable vapes. There may be some disposable vapes that try to skirt a loophole, maybe through a detachable battery or something like that to make them not disposable. So we'll see.
What was the reason behind the need to ban disposable vapes?
You know, it's kind of twofold. I mean, it's nice when two good issues come together. So we don't want nicotine addiction in our society, and we also don't want electronics going into our landfill, which have a lot of toxic metals and chemicals that leach off of them. So by their powers combined, we ban disposable vapes. So I believe Americans throw away about 5 disposable vapes every second in our country. So we have about 150 million of these disposable vapes entering our landfills every year. And that's a lot of batteries. That's a lot of electronics going into our landfill, percolating into our water supply and generally polluting our environment.
And kind of looking now into the future, aside from Act 189, there's also going to be Act 190, which is going to have a list of kind of certified vapes and e-liquids that can be sold within the state. Could you kind of expand a little bit more about just what this list is, how it's going to be made, and kind of going a little bit more into Act 190?
Yeah, so the list is made by the FDA. It's a list of 45 products right now that are approved by the FDA. That list has always been there. The feds have had the power to enforce it for many, many years, but because there's just so many products out there on the market, the feds have been unable to do so. What this bill basically does is it gives the states the power, our state, the power to go in and enforce what the feds are lacking the resources in doing. So if the 45 approved FDA products are being sold, they can still be sold legally in the state of Hawaii. But if the other products are being sold that are not on that list, then the Attorney General can go in with enforcement mechanisms to make them stop.
I'm glad you said the word enforcement mechanisms. I think that's kind of the next big topic of conversation once this all goes into effect is kind of what are those enforcement mechanisms and kind of touching up on that as well. It won't be illegal to have these vapes, right? If someone has a disposable vape, they are not going to be fined.
The law bans disposable vape selling. So it's mainly enforcing it against the retailers that are getting these products into the market. If you have a disposable vape in your pocket, you're not going to be able to sell it to anyone, but you should still be able to use it until it is hopefully disposed of properly.
What are proper disposal methods for the disposable vapes? And will there be any sort of rebate or kind of not a buyback, but you know?
Disposing of vapes is a tricky issue. They are electronics, so they do need to be disposed of properly. They have a battery that shouldn't be going into the landfill. But when I ran an e-waste recycle drive recently, they would not take disposable vapes. There are not a lot of places that will take them for recycling. I'm not sure if the vape shops will take them for recycling, but there's no real easy way to dispose of vapes. So a lot of people are just throwing it right into the garbage can. That's part of the problem and one of the reasons why we ban disposable vapes.
And you know, I know another aspect of this is protecting our keiki. A lot of young teens, you know, and I think, well, kids are really good at finding ways to get things, things that maybe they shouldn't have. I mean, is that something that you guys are thinking about now, the fact that there will be less disposable vapes, but you know, kids and young adults, they're going to find their way to get their hands on stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I was an intermediate school science teacher, so I know, kids get their hands on everything. What this is going to do, though, is it's going to make it much more expensive. I'm not saying this is a silver bullet. I know kids will still get their hands on vaping products, but because it's going to be illegal to be sold, the supply will go way down and the price will go way up. And kids generally have less access to disposable income. They don't tend to have jobs, especially when they're in elementary school. So they'll be unable to afford, is my hope, this nicotine addiction because the products will simply be out of their price range.
Right. And we actually just interviewed someone right off the street, and he had mentioned, well, I said, hey, they're going to ban disposable vapes next year. And he said, well, then what are we going to do? Start smoking cigarettes again? That's obviously something that I think is kind of raised a lot, is that, well, people equate vapes to stopping cigarette smokage. And now I think there might be a conversation to be had about, well, do you think that people will start smoking cigarettes again, especially our youth who have found that the renormalization of smoking cigarettes after smoking e-cigarettes is kind of a big deal.
I've heard this argument used a lot by vaping advocates. They're saying that vaping will allow people to quit cigarettes and eventually wean themselves off of nicotine. They're pitching it as sort of like a drug. In that case, get a prescription. to allow people to self-treat to try to get rid of an addiction to a drug that's just as addictive as heroin is crazy to me. If someone's trying to get off of heroin, we don't say, okay, have enough heroin and wean yourself back and hopefully you get off of it, but just use your own discretion. I've had a lot of friends that went from cigarettes to vaping, and what happened is they started ingesting more nicotine. They started consuming more nicotine because it became easier to do. They could do it anywhere. It smelled and tasted good. So it's actually a much more dangerous way to get your body even more addicted to nicotine rather than weaning yourself off. But again, if these people want to smoke or want to vape, we still have 45 products approved by the FDA that they can go and purchase to try to get themselves off of it. But I do want to warn people out there, if you are starting vaping to try to get yourself off of a nicotine addiction, that's probably not going to work for you. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
And I'm glad you brought up the tasting good part. I know that's a big part of vaping and something that really does, again, appeal to a younger audience, is that, well, it tastes great. I mean, is any part of this enforcement going to be put upon those flavors? I know there's going to be a list of approved products. Can flavored products still make it through onto that list?
So when we passed the bill, there were no flavored products in the 45 products that were approved by the FDA. But since we passed the bill, the FDA approved of two products, a mango flavor and a blueberry flavor. So unfortunately, we thought we were banning all flavors and it was just going to be either tobacco flavor or menthol, which I do consider menthol a flavor. But now there are two products FDA approved on the market that are flavored. So everyone who's saying that, oh my gosh, well, we're not going to have any flavored vaping products at all, there are going to be flavored vaping products available. But again, hopefully the supply will be going down so those flavored vaping products will not find their way into the hands of kids that are going to be addicted to nicotine for the rest of their lives.
I have a couple of pictures to show you. This is purely what I have seen just today. I walked around Kaneohe for 20 minutes. There's surprisingly like 4 vape shops in this general area. This was actually from someone that we had interviewed just moments ago. Will this be banned? It's a Bezoq Lemon Lime Hyper Bar.
Yes, it will be banned. And again, the only two flavors are mango and blueberry, and from a very specific brand. So that is definitely going to be not a product that is allowed.
This one is a really popular, you know what? We're going to go to a really popular one right here. It's the Geek Bar. I've heard the kids geeking. I don't know what that means. I'm assuming it has something to do with vape. But this is one of the most popular items on the market. I asked a vape shop owner, and he said, this is a number one seller. Geek Bar, how's it gonna do?
Not too well in the state of Hawaii. That is not a product that's been approved by the FDA, so your stores should not be selling it.
Geek Bar fans out there, better find a new flavor. And this is really only my only curveball that I thought, this is a fogger, and so it has a detachable battery on it. It's a rechargeable battery, and it's detachable, and all you have to do is buy the liquid cartridges. Is this considered a disposable vape? How would this do?
I'll leave it up to the AGs, but in my opinion, that's probably not a disposable vape. If you can refill it with other pods of vaping solution and you can recharge the battery, then that is meant to be reused, so it would not fall under the disposable vapes. However, because it's not one of the 45 FDA-approved items, I don't think that's going to be allowed either.
I see. So And how, I guess, stringent is this process for the FDA approval? I'm just curious. I mean, you know, we've really heard it a lot to be on this list, to get FDA approved. I mean, is it hard? Is it going to be hard for these vape products to get approved? Or is it all of a sudden, you know, they're just all going to do the paperwork and get it done? I mean, what is that process kind of like?
Normally, it's very hard. We have an interesting federal government right now. So it's hard to say what exactly is going to happen if, you know, certain people shake the right hands. But as of right now, yes, it's very hard. And a lot of these nicotine companies have been trying for years to get their company through the FDA approval process. So it is quite a long and drawn out process, and for a good reason. You're selling a product that is incredibly addicting and can fall into the wrong hands.
That was State Representative Scott Mariucci talking with HPR's Kevin Allen about the vape ban that was signed into law this month. Well, that's a wrap for today. Tomorrow, we plan to meet the new face of a dive bar who stepped in to save a mainstay of the local music scene. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.